Good evening, lovers of the macabre. I'm Alma.
I'm Lauren.
And this is
Morbid Possessions.
So,
oh God, I sound like I'm dying.
It's okay. So we've been waiting for so long to do a big heavy hitter. And honestly, this is probably like one of the serial killers that I'm most excited about. And I kind of wanted to put this one off just because once we do it, you know, we won't be able to do it again. And honestly, this is a story that's just, goddamn.
Yeah. And it's good. It's one of those ones that, you know, led me into my fascination with true crime. I'm sure you can say the same.
Yeah, definitely.
And it's the same way for a lot of people. This is what,
and
you know, they may not, my mom doesn't know a lot about true crime, but she could tell me some things about.
Yeah, about
the Manson family.
Yeah. And the time, you know, counterculture, the 60s, the 70s, it was just such a great time to be alive. That hippie culture.
Have I ever told you that the Vietnam War was a terrible war but had a great soundtrack?
That's very true.
Because the music that came out of that, the war and like that era of history,
I can definitely agree,
and still just amazing. I sound like I'm dying because I have not stopped coughing for 2 weeks.
I sounded like that last week, so I completely understand how you feel.
Like, I wish I sounded like Phoebe when she's sick and she sounds all sexy and sultry, but I sound like I smoke 3 packs a day.
I smoke 3 packs a day. That was terrible.
My wine is helping this.
Ew. So Charles Manson was born on November 12th, 1934, and he was originally named No Name Maddox until his mother finally named him weeks later to Charles Mills Maddox. He was born in Cincinnati, Ohio. His mother was an alcoholic and a prostitute, and she gave birth to him when she was only 16 years old, and the father was never in the picture. We're not even really sure if he ever really knew his real father, but there was a guy that was named Colonel Walker Henderson Scott Sr., who they believe might have been his father due to his mother, Kathleen, having filed a paternity suit on him in 1937. But she knew him as a colonel, but it said that he was actually a con artist and his legal name was Colonel.
You mean but Colonel?
Yeah, sorry, Colonel. I don't understand why they don't just spell it Colonel. I don't get it.
Like Colonel, like corn?
Yeah.
For many reasons.
Colonel, like Colonel Sanders.
Yeah.
I don't understand why it's spelled so weird. Where do they get the R?
The English language is dumb. Are we just now learning this?
So he pretended to be a colonel. And she believed him. And it was rumored that when Kathleen got pregnant, he told her he was going to go away on duty for the army to skip out on her. And she hadn't realized that he just said that to skip out on her until like months later. She discovered that he didn't really go to the army.
Wow.
So a couple months prior to Charles Manson being born, Kathleen married a man named William Eugene Manson. He was an alcoholic and he would disappear for days at a time, which you're starting to see this pattern here from very early on before he was even born. Like, this is just dysfunctional already as it is. So when Charlie was a baby, Kathleen took him to a restaurant and she was drinking at the restaurant, right?
Mm-hmm.
She talked to the waitress and the waitress was telling her like, oh, Charlie's so adorable. I wish I could have my own child, blah, 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 blah. I want a kid so bad. So Kathleen told her, oh, I'll give you Charlie for a pitcher of beer. And they kind of laughed and joked about it. But then when the waitress wasn't looking, Kathleen slipped out of the restaurant and just left Charlie there.
Oh, fuck, dude. Yo, Charlie, sorry you had a terrible childhood.
But as soon as his uncle found out what had happened to Charlie, he tracked down the waitress and took Charlie back home.
Do you think he was, like, angry about it? Like, give me my fucking nephew. Or was he like, hey, like, I'm here. Sorry that happened to you.
I'm sure he was pissed.
I wouldn't blame the waitress. I'd blame the mom for being a terrible mother. I would
definitely
mother.
Blame the mom. Because at that point, the waitress is just doing, being a good person. Like, oh, fuck.
Like, oh, fuck. It's like, a baby.
What am I going to do? Throw this baby into an orphanage? Like, no, I'm just going to raise it as my own. You're mine now.
That was like me when I saw Salem. I'm not going to keep you in this kiddie prison. You're mine.
Oh. So, William, the stepfather, or whatever he was, mom's boyfriend or whatever, he would leave Charles with different babysitters, and he'd go out drinking with Kathleen's brother, Luther. So, eventually, Kathleen and William divorced in 1937 after being married for almost 3 years. Charlie, at this point, is already showing a lot of dysfunction. When he was 6, he had some classmates beat him up. And when the adults at the school stopped the children that were beating Charlie up, they claimed that Charlie had told them to do it. They said that he said, oh, beat me up. When they interrogated Charlie about it, he responded something along the lines of that they wanted to do it and he should not be held responsible for their actions.
Wow. Yeah. Never heard that any other time out of this man's mouth.
So
I'm being sarcastic.
He would also recruit other classmates and make them attack students that he did not like. And most of these classmates were girls. He yet again claimed that he should not be held responsible for his actions and that the other children should be the ones that are getting disciplined for their actions. So he's already showing, you know, this is exactly what he does later on in life. But I completely understand how he would have other kids beat each other up. Because when I was in school, we had tiers. And I was at the top of the tier, so we had bodyguards and they would fight.
What the fuck? Where did you go to school?
In Redlands. But yeah. I was at the top of the hierarchy.
When I was in school, we used to be like super dramatic and like reenact like cheetah girls on the playground. I don't know about you, but I had a great time. I was also president of my school.
Nice. Yeah,
ASB there.
We were, I don't know. I guess I was just like, I was a shy kid, but I was also extremely sassy within my group of friends. And then Mean Girls came out when I was in elementary school. So we had a Mean Girls thing going for a little bit.
I understand that.
And on, we wore purple in the third grade.
I hate you. I used to put glue on my hand and watch it dry and then peel it off.
I did that too. I was actually a really gross kid.
I did that yesterday at work because I was bored.
So, 1 year, poor Charlie, I feel so bad for him. He received a hairbrush for Christmas because his family was so poor, and I guess he must have needed a hairbrush, so they gave it to him as a present because they couldn't afford anything else. So,
I got a banana for Christmas. I get a banana for Christmas every year from my uncle.
At least you get other presents, though. Poor Charlie only got a hairbrush.
I could literally just be happy with that banana, though.
Well, yeah.
Well, this was the first year I could actually eat the banana because it wasn't gross. My uncle's an ass, but I love him.
So, Charlie's grandmother told him that if he brushed his hair with it, he'd be able to fly like Superman. So, he started running around with his hairbrush and stuff after brushing his hair. And his classmates would all make fun of him, so he collected all the other kids' toys and burned them. Kudos to Charlie.
Wow.
That's exactly what you do when you're getting bullied. You burn other children's toys.
I would.
So,
don't blame him at this point. I'm like, you are a victim of circumstance here.
He's definitely a victim of circumstance, which is why I feel sympathetic for him early on. But then
later in life, no. That's what I want people to understand is I feel sympathetic for people.
For children.
For children. They didn't deserve this, you know, this upbringing. They don't deserve to grow up with a mental illness. You know, no one deserves to have a mental illness. It just happens. But when it gets to being a psychopath later in
life.
Yeah,
and being an adult and being able to choose your choices.
And you know what's right and what's wrong. You know what's legal and what's not.
Yeah.
I don't feel bad
even for if you don't really feel what's right and wrong, you know what will send your ass to prison, at least.
And you know what's going to harm other people, so why do it?
Yeah. So Manson was sent to live with his aunt and uncle. After William, Kathleen's mother, and Luther's girlfriend, Julia Vickers, were arrested. They were arrested for grand larceny after trying to rob an acquaintance of theirs, Frank Martin. Luther claimed that he had a gun and pointed it to Frank's back, but it actually was not a gun. He was actually just holding up a ketchup bottle against his back, and because they believed he had money. And Frank did not believe his lies. He didn't fall for it. He knew it wasn't a gun. So they beat him over the head with the ketchup bottle, which I'm going to assume is one of those, like, glass ones, like the heavy old school ones.
Man, I just wanted one of the... I really was picturing, like, you know, the squeeze bottles that doesn't have a cap. They're, like, unmarked ones. They're red.
The plastic ones?
Yeah, that they have at, like, diners.
Oh, yeah, no. I'm going to assume that it was, like, I'm going to assume that it was a glass bottle at least. So the gang escaped after they beat him over the head, and they only took $27 from him. Luther was sentenced for 10 years, and Kathleen was sentenced for 5. So
shit's wild, yeah.
During this time, Charlie is already said to be a liar, and he would blame everyone else for everything he would do that was wrong, and he always wanted to be the center of attention, which would lead him to act up when adults were around. It sounds like Charlie just kind of wanted attention because he wanted someone to care for once, to be honest.
Yo, that hurt my heart.
So... his cousin Joanne recalled a time where she was changing the sheets on the bed. And I think the aunt and uncle were out of the house at the time. So she was changing the sheets, and Charlie tried to attack her with a razor sickle that he had found outside in the yard. She pushed him off, being that she was stronger than him, and he was pretty small and scrawny at the time. So Charlie ran after her and started slicing at the screen door with the razor sickle. When his aunt and uncle got home, they asked Joanne what had happened. Joanne told them to ask Charlie. He lied and said Joanne tried to attack him, but his aunt and uncle didn't believe his lies, so they spanked him. Kathleen was finally released on parole in 1942. She hugged Charlie when she got out, and poor Charlie said that that was the happiest memory of his life.
Your mom getting out of prison.
His mom hugging him because she'd never hugged him before.
Okay, that's cute. That's sad.
So she got a cheap motel and brought Charlie to live with her. Charles Manson was stealing from stores and missing school at this time. His mom tried to put him in foster care because she wasn't able to take care of him. Or she didn't really want you, to be honest. So she sent him to but she wasn't able to put him in foster care. So she sent him to an all-boys school called Gibault School for Boys, which was run by Catholic priests when he was 12 in 1947. His happiest moments at the school were when his mom would show up to visit him and promised to take him home when she had more money. Finally, Manson was so sick of being there that he tried to run away and return to his mom, but when he found her, she slammed the door on him, told him she could not handle him, and took him back to the school. He just wanted to be with his mom, and she never picked him up.
She's a bad person. I'm sorry, but I blame
she was a teenage prostitute. Which I can understand why she was so messed up, but also, you know, like, don't be so selfish.
Like, if you know you can't take care of your child, it sounds awful, but there are people who want
She kids. Should have given him up for adoption, left him at the fire station.
Well, safe surrender at that time wasn't a thing. So if she couldn't leave him at the fire station, she would have been arrested.
Oh... she could have left him at the hospital.
Still, that's not a thing.
She was already arrested for other things. She couldn't get arrested for that. So Charlie said that the only thing his mother taught him was that everything she said was a lie. Dude, this is so heartbreaking.
Charlie, I'm sorry. You had a shit childhood.
During the Christmas of 47, when he was probably, he was 13 around that time. He went to his aunt and uncle's home, and they caught him trying to steal a gun when he was only 13. So he ran away from the school for boys 10 months after his mom had took him back to the school. And he began making it through by doing petty thefts and crimes to survive. He ended up renting a room in Indianapolis that he afforded through burglarizing stores at night. So he was only 14 at this time, maybe even still 13. He was caught committing burglary eventually, and they sent him back to a juvenile detention center named Boys Town. After 4 days, another boy in the juvenile detention center named Blackie Nielsen taught him how to steal a car, and somehow he obtained a gun. How awful is it that he was sent there to learn and gain discipline, but he came out worse? Because I hear so many stories of people going into juvie or jail, and they end up learning more tricks while they're in there. And not rehabilitating at all.
Mm-hmm. Our prison system is shit.
Our prison system sucks. And in Canada and in other places, they believe that if they don't take away what makes you human and they give you those things, you will be rehabilitated. Like in Canada, they have TVs. They can walk around and the doors are open 90% of the times, like their prison cell doors, and to go outside so they can do whatever they please whenever they please. They just can't leave. And they even have, like, they can make tea, they can make coffee, like they have entertainment. They can paint and draw. Mm-hmm. And our prison system isn't like that. You feel like an animal and the food sucks. And over there in other countries, like, you actually feel like you're human. And when you're taking away humanity, you're not going to come out a better person. You're just going to survive on your animal instincts when you get out. You're not going to be able to be normal.
So I had talked to, at the job that Alma and I were at previously, there was a customer that came in, and he was a former prosecutor. And now he works for the California prison system. And so he was telling me about, I want to say it's Pelican Bay. They're changing it. So now they're including like art programs, and you can decorate your cell and use your creative outlets in a positive manner. So like, there's this guy who painted his entire cell to look like marble.
That's amazing. Mm-hmm.
And he said, we're seeing less people offend because they're doing that. And they...
yeah, because they need an artistic outlet. In other places, it'd be more...
and they have programs on how to, like, job skill programs.
Yeah, job skill programs, more room for education.
Mm-hmm. They have GED programs in place. It's like, you know, you don't have to give them a college education. I understand that's expensive, but give them a fighting chance. So when they get out, they can have...
yeah. Here we just have, like, what, you work in the kitchen or you work in the laundry room and you get paid 10 cents a day. That's not humane at all. That's slave wages. So the boys robbed a grocery store and a casino, and they made their way to Nielsen's uncle's home in Peoria, Illinois. First of all, how did they escape juvie? These kids were, like, they knew way too much at a young age. So the uncle was a professional thief, and he took the boys in as his proteges. 2 weeks later, Manson was caught during a robbery, and they sent him to a reform school called Boys School. Manson claims that during this time, he was raped by other students at the reform school, and the acts were encouraged by one of the staff members. Ugh. Poor Charlie. So, he escaped the school with two other boys in 1951. The boys stole cars and tried to drive to California, and the way that they tried to support themselves on the road was by more burglaries, like robbing stores and stuff. They were caught, and they were sent to a boys' school in Washington, D.C., named the National Training School for Boys. When he went to the school, they did an IQ test on him, and his IQ was 109, which is only 9 points higher than the national average, which isn't terrible.
I'm sorry.
It's okay. Which isn't terrible, considering that he had never really been to school. But he was found to be illiterate during this time. A psychiatrist said that the amount of rejection, instability, and trauma he had received made him feel like he had to impress other boys at the school due to his lack of parental love.
This is just... it's so sad.
I know.
Because it's like, I know he did terrible things, but...
he was set up. It was just the life he was given. He had no choice.
You know, it's nurture versus nature.
Mm-hmm. And his whole life was fight or flight.
Yeah.
Wow. So he was transferred to Natural Bridge Honor Camp, and he was scheduled for parole. But right before his parole hearing in 52, he was caught raping another boy at knife point. He was taken to a federal reformatory in Virginia and was caught doing homosexual crimes there against other boys. So they could no longer have him there, and they sent him to a maximum security prison in Ohio.
When he was adults?
It was 52, so he was already 18.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, because he was born in 34, so he was already of age by then. So he was taken to the... okay, so he was released to his aunt and uncle in 54, and in January of 1955, Charles Manson married a woman named Rosalie Jean Willis, who was a hospital waitress. He impregnated her and took her to California in a stolen car.
Ew, can you not say it like that?
Impregnated?
Ew.
Manson was charged again for having taken a stolen car across state lines. He was given 5 years probation after they gave him a psychiatric evaluation, but he failed to appear at his hearing. So, therefore, he was sentenced to 3 years at Terminal Island in San Pedro, California. So, Rosalie ends up giving birth and naming the son Charles Manson Jr. in 1956. She was only 15 when she gave birth to Charles Manson Jr., which means that the father, Charles Manson, was 20 at the time when he had impregnated her. So she was only 14 when she got knocked up. But during that time, that was the norm, unfortunately. She, along with Charles Manson's mother, would go visit him in prison, and Charles Manson's mother, Kathleen, was said to have helped Rosalie and baby Charlie get by, and I think they might have even lived together. So at this point, Kathleen was being supportive, and she was helping for the first time in her life. Wow. So eventually, Rosalie met someone else and moved in with the man and stopped visiting Charles in prison. So... she stopped visiting Charles, and 2 weeks before Charles was scheduled for parole, he tried to escape by stealing a car, and he was given an additional 5 years probation, and his parole was denied. In September of 1958, Charles Manson received 5 years parole. During this time, him and Rosalie were getting a divorce as well. So the sad thing about Charles Manson's son, Charles Manson Jr., is that he... wasn't able to live his life peacefully. He couldn't escape his name. He even changed his name legally, but he couldn't escape the infamy of being known as Charles Manson's son. So he actually ended up committing suicide as an adult. Yeah, but there are plenty of other children out there that are Charles Manson's children. So.
And they're like proven that they're. Children.
Yeah,
like
well, he was sleeping with everyone.
I know he was sleeping with everyone, but...
they are proven to be his children. I'm not sure how many he has out there. I don't think their names are out. I'm not sure. I haven't looked into the other children.
I'm sorry, but I would hide that.
I would hide that as well. So, a month after he was released on parole, Charles Manson was caught pimping out a 16-year-old girl. And he was being taken care of by wealthy girls whose parents supported them. There was a wealthy girl who was supporting Charles Manson during that time. But September of 59, Charles pleaded guilty for attempting to cash a forged treasury check, which is extremely illegal.
Mm-hmm.
Like, to try to cash an illegal check is one thing, but a treasury check is a complete other thing. He claimed that he stole it out of a mailbox, and he received a 10-year suspended sentence and probation. But after a woman named Leona pleaded before the court and said that her and Charlie were deeply in love, and if he were to be freed, they could marry. So they ended up kind of cutting him some slack, and they ended up getting married that year. Manson took Leona and another woman to New Mexico to prostitute them, and he was held in question for violating the Mann Act, which states that it's a felony to engage in interstate or foreign commerce transport of any woman or girl for the purpose of prostitution or debauchery, or for any other immoral purpose. Manson was released once again, but violated his probation by disappearing. A warrant was issued for his arrest, and an indictment for his violation of the act of transporting the woman was issued April of 1960.
Wait, so it would have been illegal to say, fly your side chick to some state to go do your dues?
No.
Because it's immoral acts.
It's, I don't necessarily know if that would have been considered illegal, but he was
60s at this point.
He was taking them out.
They're all weird about sex.
Yeah, but he was taking them out to pimp them out, which is
illegal.
Yeah. He was a pimp. So one of the women was arrested for prostitution, and Manson was arrested in June in Texas and was sent back to LA.
So he was sent to LA.
Yeah. So after that, he was ordered to serve 10 years for his prior charge from cashing the forged check. So Manson tried to revoke his probation, but he was transferred from LA County Jail to the United States Penitentiary at McNeil Island in Washington. There in prison, he heard the Beatles for the first time, and all of a sudden, he got this idea that he wanted fame and he wanted to be liked and known just like the Beatles. So he somehow got a guitar in prison, and he took guitar lessons from an inmate nicknamed Creepy. He obtained the contact name of Phil Kaufman, who was at Universal Studios, by another inmate. It said that his mother moved nearby the prison and worked as a waitress to get by. So at this point, it seems like his mom is becoming more prominent in his life. For some reason, she wants to be near Charlie. Maybe it's now that he's an adult, he has all of this charisma, and she wants to be around him. Who knows? In 1963, Leona divorced Charles, and she claimed she had a son with Charles named Charles Luther. I don't really understand why she would give him his uncle's name as the middle name, which is, I find, kind of odd.
Mm-hmm.
But whatever. In 1965, it's rumored that Charles auditioned for the Monkees, but he did not make it. This rumor is said to be false, though, due to that Charles would have still been behind bars during that time. So then, in June 1966, Charles was sent to Terminal Island once again for the second time, and he was set for an early release. He begged the authorities not to let him go, and he claimed that he could not handle being on the outside. He was released on March 21st, 1967, and spent half of his life behind bars and institutions by then. So he's been in institutions since he was 13 at this time, and it's already 67.
It literally feels like that's all he knows, and that's all. And he's reoffending because he's comfortable with that.
And that's the only way he knows how to survive. He doesn't know how to get a job. That's why he keeps committing robberies. So, Manson heads to San Francisco to the Height and Ashbury district with another inmate, and they get a small apartment in Berkeley. He mostly got by begging for change here, but he ends up meeting a 23-year-old named Mary Brunner, who was a library assistant at the University of Berkeley. Manson moved in with her, and even though she refused at first, he ended up moving 18 other women into her apartment after she had told him originally no.
Yeah, are you also paying rent?
I'm going to assume not.
You add into the grocery bill? Freeloader.
So then they're obviously taking over her room. That's fucked up.
Mm-hmm.
Like, she's paying all the bills and she's probably sleeping on the floor. At some point, he meets Patricia Kernwinkle in Manhattan Beach and tells her, you're ugly, I'm ugly, and that they were the only two people who would call each other beautiful. They ended up making love that night, and Patricia cried after he called her beautiful. She ran off with him with the expectations that he was going to be her boyfriend, but she quickly learned that she was not going to be the only woman in his life.
So if you look at pictures of her back then, she's not, you know, when he says, like, we're the only two that are going to call each other beautiful, it's like,
no, but he was just praying.
Yeah, because she was so insecure.
Yeah, he preys on insecurities. And, I mean, everyone has some slight insecurity in one way or another. And he knows how to find that to mm-hmm. make you his friend and try to build you up in a way where you're wrapped around his finger. I wonder
how long he had to talk to someone before he realized what their insecurity was.
Who knows? So they made love that night, and she cried after he called her beautiful. She ran off with him, expecting to be the only woman, but obviously that wasn't going to happen. So she took off to San Francisco with him and two other women. In the Height and Ashbury district, during the summer of love, he became a self-proclaimed guru. He began preaching that Satan and God would reconcile, and once they reconciled, they would end the world. He called his followers original Christians, and that he stated that they were reincarnated, and he heavily implied that he was Jesus Christ reincarnated. He would also tell his fathers that he had visions of himself being nailed on the cross, and he began going by an alias of Charles Willis Manson, which sounds a lot like Charles Will is Man's son, which implied that he was the son of man. He would also give his followers acid, and he would always take a lower dosage than them, which shows that he was trying to remain in control and kind of create this illusion of knowledge and grandiose. He would make his followers reenact his crucifixion while they were on acid, which is fucking gnarly, dude.
That sounds scary.
That sounds terrifying.
I think it sounds terrifying to watch that 70s show on acid.
That's, I don't know about that one.
No, do you know what else makes me nervous to think about?
What?
Alice in Wonderland.
Alice in Wonderland would be trippy.
I would throw up.
I don't know. Jesus Christ, his, like, watching or just reenacting the crucifixion, that would be too much for me. I would never come back. I would just lose my mind. I would be in a straitjacket in the hospital for the rest of my life.
See, when I drink too much, like, wine and I watch something like that, I'm like, oh, I'm going to die.
You're such a pansy.
Fuck off, bitch. I am who I am, okay?
So before the end of the summer, he took some of his followers in a hippie-style bus. And they went on a road trip, and they ended up in Los Angeles. Mary Brunner became pregnant by Manson and gave birth to Valentine Michael, a.k.a. Pooh Bear, on April 15, 1968. Women in the family helped her give birth, and Mary Brunner went by several different nicknames, one of them being Mother Mary. It's just so fucking gross. Charles Manson would send the girls out to look for celebrities and musicians in the LA area, so they would go out scouting for him. One day, Patricia and Ella Bailey got picked up by Dennis Wilson, the drummer of the Beach Boys, while hitchhiking. So he takes them to the house and takes off to go to the recording studio. When he returns, Charles Manson's in his driveway, and Wilson asks if he's going to hurt him. which Manson responds to him that he has no intention, and he begins kissing his feet. How fucking weird is that?
I literally would be like, bro, fuck off.
Bro, leave my piggies alone.
Leave my piggies alone.
So when they enter the home, Wilson discovers that Manson has brought more girls with him. They're walking around topless and swimming in his pool. Dennis loved women, so he didn't really mind that Charles Manson had moved in with all of his girls for a while. More women moved in, and eventually they ended up costing Wilson about $100,000 after crashing his car and having him pay for the treatment of all of the women's gonorrhea. Disgusting.
Disgusting.
So Wilson would sing and talk with Manson while the women served them. And Wilson thought that Manson was a musical genius. Manson preyed on Wilson's insecurities and built him up to feel better about himself. And he grew on Wilson. Wilson paid for studio time for Manson and introduced him to other celebrities and other Hollywood hotshots. Manson met Charles Tex Watson through Wilson after Wilson had picked him up one day when Tex's car had died out on the road. Charles gave him the nickname Tex due to his, I guess he had like a Texan accent. Wilson moved out of his home when the lease expired, and eventually the Manson family was evicted because obviously they couldn't be there. So during that time, the Manson family moved into Spahn Ranch, August of 1968.
I'm straight cheesing right now.
They used to film TV shows and westerns on the ranch, but by the 60s, the ranch had become run down, and the only thing done there were horse rides. The females did chores around the ranch in return for living there, and the women would also have sex with Spahn whenever Charles would tell them to in return for living there. Lynette Fromm acquired the nickname Squeaky, being that she would squeak whenever George Spahn would pinch her thigh. I've heard different things about why they called her Squeaky, and one of them, it wasn't because he was pinching her thigh. It was because she would squeak while having intercourse.
Ew. I don't want to know about her moaning.
So Manson wrote a
squeaking.
Song. Ew. Manson wrote a song named Cease to Exist, and Dennis Wilson took that song to the Beach Boys. He changed some of the lyrics and named it Never Learn Not to Love. When the song was released, it was only credited to Dennis Wilson, and Manson was pissed, so pissed, and ended up threatening Dennis Wilson. Manson befriends Terry Melcher, and he wanted to make it as a rock star during this time. Melcher even recorded Manson's music at Spahn Ranch, and Manson claimed that Terry had given him a contract. Terry has second thoughts eventually and tells him, you know what, I wouldn't know what to do with you. I don't really want to work with you. And so this really pissed Charles off. For a while, Charles Manson had been talking about doing a race war. And he was claiming that Black people were going to take over the world and that the Beatles were predicting this race war. He also thought that the White Album was directed towards the Manson family and that they were the only ones who could stop this race war. During January of 1969, not that kind of crazy. During January of 1969, the family moved into a yellow home near Spahn Ranch, and they called it the Yellow Submarine after the Beatles song. They prepared for the apocalypse and named it Helter Skelter after another Beatles song. The family was to create an album to predict the chaos, and they were to live in a secret city underneath Death Valley as the apocalypse occurred, and they were supposed to rise after the apocalypse. Which is very, very delusional. And at this point, it just sounds like they're fucking perma-fried or so fried out that they're just making up these crazy scenarios in their head.
How did anyone ever survive the 60s?
Not well.
So Linda Ann, if you're listening, I need to know. That's my grandma.
So the family worked with maps to prepare for their desert escape, while others worked on cars to escape, and they worked on songs for their album. One night, they were told that Melcher was going to come over to hear their music. So the woman cleaned up and prepared dinner, but he never showed up. So an alternative theory to Helter Skelter is that Bobby Beausoleil, a friend of the family, had been arrested for the murder of Gary Hinman, and the family had committed murder to make them release Bobby due to the killer being at large, which is on March 23rd, 1969. Charles Manson showed up at 150 Cielo Drive, the old residence of Terry Melcher. The new tenants of the home were now Roman Polanski and Sharon Tate. Shira Katami, a friend of Roman and Sharon, who was there to photograph Sharon before they left for Rome the following day, met Manson at the front porch when he showed up, and he asked him what he wanted. Charles asked him about a person that Hitami did not recognize, so he informed him that it was the Polanski Tate residence that he was at. He told him he could try the back alley at the guest house. Hitami was concerned, so he walked down to confront Manson, and during this time, Roman and Sharon came outside, and minutes afterwards, Charles Manson comes around the back and leaves without seeing anything. So Manson returned later that evening to the guest house behind the Polanski Tate residence, and he spoke to Alto Belli, and he demanded to talk to Terry Melcher, and he was asking about him. So Alto Belli informed him that Melcher no longer lived there, and he had moved to Malibu. Alto Belli lied and told Charles that he did not know his new address. I would have lied too. There's no way in hell I was going to tell some weird, strange guy showing up at my house at night, like where Terry Melcher had moved.
If he had, things may have changed for Sharon Tate.
Oh, they might have, but that doesn't make it any better.
No, it doesn't make it any better. But if you think of, if you really think about it, if he had said it.
He might have, but he might have also returned to the Polanski Tate residence just out of vengeance. So Alto Belli told Manson that he would be leaving the country the next day. So when Manson told him that he'd like to talk to Alto Belli when he returned, he told him he'd be gone for a year. Manson told him he had been directed by Alto Belli by the main house. So Alto Belli at this point tells Charles Manson not to ever return and disturb his tenants, like the Polanskis and the Tates.
Yeah.
So on May 18th, 1969, Terry Melcher went to Spahn Ranch to hear Charles and the Manson family sing. He came to visit another time shortly after with a mobile recording device, but he did not record. By June of 1969, Manson began telling the family that it was their time to teach the black people.
Oh, love that.
He actually said the blacks how to start Helter Skelter. Manson told Tex to obtain money to prepare the family. So Tex ends up defrauding a black drug dealer named Crow. And this guy named Crow afterwards threatens everyone at Spahn's Ranch after he is ripped off. So on July 1st of 1969, the family shoots Crow at Manson's Hollywood apartment. Manson believed that Crow had been a Black Panther. And so the news ends up airing Crow's death, and they wrongfully confirmed his assumption that he was a Black Panther. But when they found his body, Manson turned Spahn Ranch into a defensive camp, assuming that the Black Panthers were going to come after them. But he wasn't even a Black Panther. He was just being fucking racist. On July 25th, 1969, Manson sent Bobby Beausoleil, Mary Brunner, and Susan Atkins to Gary Hinman's home under the belief that he had money that they could take. They held Hinman for 3 days, and Charles showed up and slashed his ear with a sword.
Someone was like Vincent Van Gogh?
Yeah, basically. So he slashes his ear with a sword, and after that, Beausoleil stabbed Hinman to death, claiming Manson had told him to, and they wrote political piggy on the wall with Hinman's blood, along with a Black Panther paw, to make it seem like the Black Panthers had done it. Beausoleil later claimed in interviews that they had went there to recover money because Hinzman had sold them bad drugs, so they were just reclaiming what was theirs. And Beausoleil claimed that Brenner and Atkin didn't even know what the plan was in the beginning. They didn't know that they had planned to kill him. So Atkin's leader stated that Manson had told him them to go there and get Hinzman's inheritance of $21,000. Beausoleil was pulled over driving Hinzman's cars on August 6th of 1969, and they found the murder weapon in the vehicle. On August 8th, 1969, Manson told Tex to take Susan, Linda, and Patricia to 150 Cielo Drive, and they were instructed to kill everyone there, despite knowing Manson already knew that Melcher wasn't there. He already knew he didn't live there. But he told Manson told the girls to follow Tex's instructions. So Tex and Manson, the Manson girls, arrive to the home after midnight. They park at the bottom of the hill leading up to the home and walked the rest of the way. Thinking that they had an alarm system, Tex climbs with a pole on the side of the home and cuts the electric wires leading to the home. As they got into the property, a car began driving down the driveway and towards them. So Tex told the girls to lie and hide behind the bushes. Tex stopped the driver, which was 15-year-old Stephen Parent, who had been visiting William Garrickson, who lived in the guest house in the back, and he had went there in hopes of selling a clock radio to him. Tex points his .22 revolver at the boy, and the boy pleads for mercy and tells him he would go on his way and not tell anyone what he saw. So Tex lunges at him with a knife, and Parent raised his arm at this time to defend himself. Tex gashes his palm with a knife and took his watch off of his wrist. Then he shot Parent four times in the chest and abdomen, and he had the girls push the car further up the driveway. So Tex goes and slashes the screen of a window and tells Linda to keep watch down by the gate. He took the screen off and let Patricia and Susan in through the front door. A friend of Polanski, Frykowski, was sleeping on the couch. Tex kicked him in the head, and Frykowski woke up confused, asking him who he was and what he was doing there, which Tex responded, "I'm the devil, and I'm here to do the devil's business." Susan and Patricia found everyone else who was inhabiting the house, including Sharon Tate, Jay Sebring, and Abigail Folger, so he brought them into the living room. Sharon Tate was a hot Hollywood starlet who had become most well-known for her role in Valley of the Dolls, and she was now married to Hollywood director Roman Polanski, who had just directed Rosemary's Baby the year prior. Polanski was out in Europe at the time working on a film. Tex tied Sharon Tate and Jason Bring together by the neck with a rope and threw the rope over a ceiling beam. Frykowski's hands were tied with a towel. Jay begged Tex to let Sharon go. Tex shoots Jay. Abigail Folger was taken to get her purse and give them her money, which she only had $70 in her purse. Then Tex stabbed Jay Sebring seven times. Frykowski unties his hands. They were only tied with a towel, so he is able to untie himself. And he begins to fight with Susan Atkins, who starts stabbing at him. At his legs with a knife. He struggles out onto the porch through the front door. Tex strikes him over the head multiple times, stabs him multiple times, and shoots him twice. Like, Jesus Christ, at this point, he's done enough. He's going to die.
Like, he will not survive, even if he escapes.
Yeah. So Linda heard everything that was happening, so she ran up to the home, told them that someone was coming, which was a very pathetic attempt to stop the murders. Folger escaped from Patricia, and she goes out near the pool. So Pat's chasing after her and tackles her and stabs Abigail Folger on the front lawn. Tex stabs Abigail 28 more times after that.
I've watched countless documentaries. I've read books. I've listened to podcasts about it. But every time I hear in description what happened to these individuals, I feel speechless.
Yeah.
And heartbroken that those were their last moments. What a terrifying thing to have to deal with.
Yeah, I think what gets me worst is Sharon's death, but we're getting to that one.
I mean, of course.
Yeah, so Frykowski's still alive, and even though there's no way that he's going to survive his wounds, Tex stabs him an additional 51 times. Sharon Tate is begging for her lives and begs them to allow her to live long enough, just long enough to give birth, and she even offers to give herself hostage to them, but Atkins and or Watson, it's not clarified if it's Atkins or Watson or the both, they stab Sharon Tate 16 times after drawing an X on her pregnant belly. Sharon Tate was only 26 when she was murdered. So Susan Atkins writes pig in Sharon Tate's blood across the front door.
Because Charlie had said, if you're going to do something, leave something witchy.
Yeah. So the next night, Charles Manson takes the gang, plus Leslie Van Houten and Steve Clem Grogan out to Los Feliz to the La Bianca residence to show them how it's done after being unhappy with the panic and sloppiness of the night before. The Manson family had been to a party that was next door to the La Bianca's before. So Charles goes into the home and comes out stating that he had tied up the residents of the home. Tex goes up to the home with Pat and Leslie. Charles points out a sleeping Leno La Bianca through the window, and him and Tex enter through the back door. Manson roughed up Leno and held him at gunpoint as Tex tied him up with a leather thong. His wife, Rosemary, is brought into the living room, and Tex covers their heads with pillowcases and wraps lamp cords around their heads to hold the pillow covers in place. Charles leaves and sends Pat and Susan into the house to kill the couple. Tex sent the woman along with Rosemary into the room while he stabbed Leno with a bayonet 12 times. The girls took turns stabbing her, and Leslie Van Houten claims that she had only stabbed her 17 times post-mortem. Only 17 times post-mortem.
Oh, only.
Like, what's the point? They're already dead. An autopsy showed that Rosemary was stabbed 41 times post-mortem. Tex cleaned the bayonet and took a shower. While Pat wrote death to the pigs and riots on the walls, she also wrote helter skelter on the fridge, which wasn't even pronounced properly. She pronounced it H-E-A-L-T-E-R in blood. If we're going to do something, at least do it right. So Pat stabbed Leno 14 times with a carving fork, jutting out his stomach with it, and he put a steak knife in his throat. Charles, meanwhile, had taken the other three members to the home of a celebrity and instructed them to kill at the home. Linda Kasabian knocked on the wrong apartment door, so they left, and obviously after having someone seeing them and drawing attention to themselves. So after this, Susan Atkins left a bowel movement at a stairway on the way out. The whole gang had a hitchhike back home.
Why shit in the hall?
They just sound like, they kind of sound like teenagers who don't know what to fucking do, but to an extreme, like, what the fuck are you doing?
Like, you're literally just being disgusting. The worst kind of, it is one thing to shit in the stairs. That's nasty. That takes a different kind of crazy. But it takes another kind of crazy to stab someone 17 times, to carve an X into a woman's pregnant belly. It's mind-boggling how fucked up they were.
Yeah, because later on, I think Tex ended up mentioning that he was on a lot of speed during the time. So they were just, like, whacked out.
Yeah.
So the whole gang had to hitchhike back home. Charles Manson had left both of the groups by themselves to find their own way back home. So in October of 1969, some of the Manson family were arrested at Spahn Ranch for car theft and crimes, other crimes. Among these those were arrested was Susan Atkins, who could not wait to brag to her cellmates about the murder of Sharon Tate. Sooner than later, Susan Atkins, Leslie Van Houten, Patricia Kernwinkel, Charles Tex Watson, and Charles Manson were arrested and being tried for the Tate and LaBianca murders. They originally all received a death sentence, but in 1972, it was ruled over in the state of California, having been deemed unconstitutional. The trials were a circus. The girls would dress up in dresses, and they would sing in the out in front of the news people. Like, they were just causing a spectacle. They would yell out random things during the trial and get sent to a different room. The Manson girls, who were not on trial, would camp out outside and cause a spectacle as well. The Manson girls even shaved their heads at some point during the trial, and they were just trying to gain as much attention as they possibly could. So Susan Atkins was denied parole 14 times, and she ended up dying in prison in 2009 from cancer at the age of 61. While she was still alive, she requested a compassionate release due to her illness, which was denied. Patricia Kernwinkel, she's still in prison and is the longest incarcerated female in America. She's also been denied parole 14 times, most recently in 2017. She remains in prison to this day. Charles Manson was denied parole 12 times, and in 1997, he began refusing to go to his parole hearings. He died in prison on November 19, 2017, at the age of 83. Leslie Van Houten is the youngest woman to have ever been put on death row at the age of 21. She's been denied parole 22 times, most recently this year in 2019, and she still remains in prison to this day. Charles Tex Watson has been denied parole 17 times, the most recent in 2016, and he still remains in prison to this day, and he now claims to be a born-again Christian.
And don't forget about our girl Squeaky.
What happened to Squeaky?
Squeaky tried to kill the president.
Oh, yeah. Squeaky did try to kill the president. I forgot about that.
In a cape, like a full-on cloak, like Red Riding Hood status.
Goddamn. Yeah, she might have escaped getting imprisoned for the deaths because she wasn't involved in those, but that's still pretty fucking crazy.
And some believe that Squeaky is still, to this day, the most dedicated Manson follower.
She might be. Yeah, I mean, that was a crazy story. You know, I've seen interviews with Charles Tex Watson, and he seems like he might be the only one who regrets it the most genuinely. But I mean, even I still wouldn't approve any of their paroles ever.
You don't. You know, you may learn from your situation, but when you do something so heinous, you don't get the right to enter back into society.
No, it doesn't matter if you were a young adult during that time and now you're old. You might have had time to think, to reflect back on, you know, what you did. But still, no, that is just way too heinous.
You took someone's life. You took multiple people's lives. You took the opportunity of a baby being born.
It's not even one person.
There's so many lives that you destroyed. Roman Polanski they had accused him of his wife's murder because Rosemary's baby had just came out.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a stunt for his movies, and that he was, you know, partaking in the occult.
Yeah.
So he was getting blamed for this. You ruined so many people's lives. You don't get.
Yeah. You don't get the chance to come back out and pretend like nothing ever happened and just start your own life, especially Susan Atkins. Like, she tried to pull the cancer card and say, like, oh, well, I'm dying. Like, let me go on a compassionate release. Like, no, you don't get that chance anymore.
I think you have the right to better yourself morally.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, better your education, what you can do. Become a positive member of your prison system.
Yeah. Like, go ahead
and be a model inmate. but you don't get to be a part of society at that point.
Yeah, no. Like, go ahead and become as morally righteous as you want in prison and do as many good deeds as you want from the inside, but you're not going to have that chance to come back out again. Do you have any further comments, Lauren?
This is... I don't want to say favorites.
I don't want to say favorites, but it's...
You understand what I'm saying, yeah. Though, right?
I think this
it's one of those ones that I love to talk about. I can hear Salem crying over there now. We've been in here for a while. But I'm fascinated by it.
Yeah, I think this is one of the most fascinating true crime stories and one of the most well-known as well, which is why we have our Spawn Ranch t-shirt. It's just a very fascinating story. And maybe now, if you didn't know what the shirt meant before, now you know that that's why we made that t-shirt for the Spawn Ranch movie ranch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a... And did you look into the custody battle with Charlie's body?
Oh, yeah. It ended up going to kind of like a super fan. He would write to him in prison and... They had never really known each other in person prior to him going in prison, but they became such good friends being that they had so much in common being with like their family history and stuff that they ended up becoming friends. So then he would end up visiting Charles in prison and he ended up getting Charles Manson ended up leaving the body to this gentleman. Mm-hmm. And this gentleman is still a Manson follower. And to this day, he claims that Manson never did anything wrong. He never touched anyone and it wasn't fair to him. And they even have a memorial site at Spawn Ranch where he goes to regularly and other people visit as well.
I didn't know you could actually go to Spawn Ranch. I really want to go.
Yeah, well, it's
sounding super morbid.
It's on a hiking trail. It's a state park.
Oh.
Yeah.
Let's go. I don't like to hike, but... We'll take our shirts. We'll take cool pictures.
I'm not going to take that shirt there. That is so disrespectful.
People can say that our podcast is disrespectful. People can say that most podcasts.
Talking about true crime is, I don't feel like it's disrespectful because it's a very fascinating, you know, it's very fascinating and a lot of people enjoy hearing these kinds of stories, but I would never show up at the old Polanski Tate residence or the La Bianca residence or even any location. I don't feel like I'd be able to show up anywhere associated with the Manson family in a shirt like that.
Fair enough.
Just out of my own personal respect. Fair enough.
I mean, I understand the La Bianca and the Polanski Tate residence. That's, yeah.
Yeah, I just wouldn't want to be caught in something like that. That's just...
I want to know something. What were your thoughts on Once Upon a Time in Hollywood? I never saw it, but it's loosely based off of this story. Yeah,
it's very, very loosely based. I wish they would have followed the storyline a bit closer. It was a very good movie, being that it was Quentin Tarantino, but I mean... Some of the parts of it I wasn't really a fan of. I didn't care too much for the ending. It was still a great movie. It was an amazing movie. But it was too much of a happy ending. And I just wish they would have had more murder. But, I mean, it was still really good. I like how they ended, despite knowing what the real ending was. If you haven't seen it, I would definitely recommend watching it. It was a much happier ending than the real story.
Well, maybe we'll watch it tonight.
But yeah.
Just kidding. We're going to go to the bar.
Yeah. And hopefully they have ginger beer there.
They have White Claw.
That's alcoholic. But, so, I mean, check out our shirts. We have those out on our Etsy. You can find us under Etsy at Morbid Possessions. We have our Spawn Ranch shirt there. We also have our murder shirt there, which also has Charles Manson's name. check it out. We have some stuff. We have something from, we have a unisex shirt for men and women, and we also have our Spawn Ranch shirt, which is for women. We have almost all the sizes, so go check it out. And, you know, thanks for being supportive. We definitely have a couple more things in mind for the future.
Yes, we are in the designing process for some very new and exciting things that will be announced
once shortly. We have them prepared.
We want them to be perfect, and takes a lot of time and effort to make sure that they're exactly what we have pictured in our minds.
Yeah, definitely. But thanks for listening. Hopefully we haven't scared you guys away. And we do have some new listeners. We just discovered we have some new Canadian listeners. We have some listeners in Austria and Australia. So thank you for listening, you guys. And, you know, our listeners are always expanding, and we're very happy about all of the support that we've received. So, you know, thank you.
Thank you, guys. We love you.
We love you. And stay
morbid. Bye, guys.